In the rugged borderlands between Syria, Turkey, and Iraq, something unprecedented unfolded in 2014. As ISIS swept through the region with apocalyptic brutality, the world witnessed an extraordinary sight. Kurdish women with braided hair and flowered scarves standing against the black flags of terror. These weren't just support troops, they were commanders, snipers, and tactical leaders earning the full respect of their male counterparts. While American women were still fighting for combat roles in their military, Kurdish women had formed their own fighting units and were leading men into battle against the world's most feared terrorist organization. Their story captivated global attention when images emerged from the besieged town of Kobani, showing these fierce women warriors facing down an enemy that enslaved women as policy. This wasn't just a military campaign. It was simultaneously advancing one of the Middle East's most progressive women's equality movements while defeating ISIS on the battlefield. Syria's Kurds endured generations of discrimination under the Assad regime, banned language, denied citizenship, confiscated land, and brutal suppression. The 2004 Qamishli incident, where authorities killed Kurdish soccer fans, radicalized many, including former athlete Azima and her friend Rojda, who joined underground military training. When Syria's civil war created a power vacuum in 2011, they joined the People's Protection Unit's YPG. Their ideology stemmed from PKK founder Abdullah Öcalan's philosophy that Kurdish liberation required women's liberation. "You cannot be empty-handed when someone attacks you," Rojda explained. After fighting alongside men for 2 years, women formed their own group, the Women's Protection Units, YPJ, in April 2013. Leaders like Nauruz insisted women deserved separate units after proving themselves in battle. The YPJ established camps combining military training with education on equality. For many Kurdish women, joining represented escape from traditional constraints. Zanarin, whose relatives had pressured her father to halt her political activities, found purpose in the YPJ. What began as hundreds of fighters in 2013 grew to thousands by 2016, preparing them for the coming confrontation with ISIS. When ISIS launched its sophisticated assault on Kobani in September 2014, Azima led several hundred fighters on the southern front line. With no safe retreat, the entire town became a battlefield. For ISIS, capturing Kobani would secure the road connecting their capital Raqqa to Aleppo and help control the Syrian-Turkish border. Azima earned her soldiers' respect by staying at the front, never asking others to do what she wouldn't. "The secret is to keep calm," she told snipers. "No movement, no excitement. Any excitement at all, and you won't hit your target." By early October, ISIS controlled three-quarters of the encircled city. Despite withdrawal orders, some YPJ members stayed to fight, including RN Mir Khan, who sacrificed herself by detonating a grenade near an ISIS tank. Kobani's proximity to Turkey allowed Western media to capture the battle. Images of women fighters facing ISIS alone spread through social media, creating a compelling narrative that pressured world leaders to act. By November, momentum shifted when Peshmerga fighters arrived from Iraqi Kurdistan, and President Obama authorized weapon airdrops and increased air support, despite Turkish objections. By January 2015, the tide had turned against ISIS. American airstrikes targeted their convoys, while Kurdish forces reclaimed territory. Despite orders to stay back, Azima led her unit to reinforce the eastern front line. After taking down an ISIS tank with a grenade, Azima was shot while defending a school position, suffering eye and heart injuries. Though severely wounded, she managed to shoot her attacker before evacuation. Despite doctors' warnings about the bullet near her heart, she attended the January 26th victory announcement when Kobani was declared liberated, ISIS's first defeat. Standing before cameras with five male commanders, she declared, "Now that Kobani is free, what we want to tell the world is that women have played a great role in liberating this town." This victory proved ISIS could be defeated and solidified the American-Kurdish partnership. While Western observers credited American air power, those on the ground knew the weapons drop and ground forces were equally crucial. While fighting ISIS, Kurdish leadership implemented a radical democratic governance experiment. Their Charter of the Social Contract established local councils, outlawed torture, recognized multiple languages, and guaranteed ethnic minorities' rights. The charter mandated women's equality with 40% female representation in governing bodies, the region's most progressive stance on women's rights. Towns under Kurdish control featured joint male-female leadership and women's councils addressing opportunities across all domains. This philosophy stemmed from Abdullah Öcalan's prison writings, influenced by Murray Bookchin's concepts of neighborhood assemblies and ecological democracy. As the U.S.-Kurdish military alliance strengthened, discussions led to the Syrian Democratic Council representing Kurds, Arabs, Turkmen, Yazidis, and Christians. In January 2016, Brett McGurk, the U.S. Special Presidential Envoy, visited northeastern Syria, providing the international legitimacy Syrian Kurds had long sought. This partnership would soon face its greatest test in liberating ISIS's capital. By 2016, Rojda commanded about 4,000 fighters, both Arab and Kurdish, men and women, on the western front line in the battle for Raqqa. She drew motivation from women rescued from ISIS captivity, including Dalal, a Yazidi woman sold 10 times as a sex slave. After months of debate, the Trump administration approved direct arming of Syrian Kurds in May 2017. American Special Forces officer Jason Aachen quickly recognized that the women commanders shared his warrior ethos, despite initial reservations about female leaders. The battle was brutal, a hellish urban environment with snipers, mortar fire, and booby-trapped buildings impeding every advance. By late August, the SDF held nearly two-thirds of Raqqa, but at tremendous cost. Over 1,000 civilian deaths and more than 100 SDF fighters killed. On October 17, 2017, Rojda arrived at Raqqa's Naim Square to celebrate victory. This space, once ISIS's Hell Square, where severed heads were displayed on spikes, now hosted triumphant SDF fighters honoring fallen comrades like Aaron Mirkan. 6 months after ISIS's defeat, Turkey launched an offensive against northeastern Syria in October 2019 following President Trump's withdrawal of American forces. The SDF, having dismantled their defenses at America's request, faced Turkey alone despite years of loyal partnership. For Nauruz, Rojda, Znarin, and Azima, this meant returning to war. Yet they remained committed to their vision. "I fight so people can live freely," Nauruz explained. In areas under SDF control, women remain visible everywhere, with civil and women's councils functioning. "We are trying to build a little lake in the middle of the desert," explained Fawzia Yusuf, who helped write the region's progressive constitution. The Daughters of Kobani reveals not just a military victory against a brutal enemy, but a revolution in gender relations in one of the world's most conservative regions. These women warriors proved that liberation requires transforming society itself. Their struggle continues both against external threats and for a vision of gender equality in building a democratic future.